Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian. In this hour, tons of discarded plastic are choking off the oceans, killing wildlife, and building islands of garbage. How bad has it become, and what can be done about it?
The ocean is awash with plastic, so much so that giant patches of discarded plastic items, toothbrushes, bottles, bags, are forming in the Pacific Ocean. Plastic pieces are killing off wildlife that swallow or get choked by them. What can be done about the mounds and mounds of plastic that is killing off our ocean life? With us is Charles Moore. He is the founder of the Algalita Marine Research and Education Institute in Long Beach and a captain in the U.S. Merchant Marine. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Charles Moore. It's great to have you here with us.
Great to be with you.
So you recently returned from a trip to research these garbage patches in the ocean. If you could start helping us understand what exactly these garbage patches are and how many are there.
They are fairly stable current systems in the ocean that are under high pressure cells, and they are north and south of the equator, about the latitude of terrestrial deserts. So they're what we call the subtropics. They're in between the equatorial zone, which is tropical, and the northern zone, which is arctic and cold. So this is moderate temperatures and dominated by high pressure. High pressure simply means that the weight of the atmosphere above these areas is greater than in other parts of the Earth. That's because the air is heated at the equator and rises and creates these mountains of air over the mid-latitudes before they condense and come down in the poles. So this mountain of air that's over these subtropical zones descends in a clockwise rotation in the northern hemisphere and in a counterclockwise rotation in the southern hemisphere. And as it descends in this gentle movement, it pulls on the surface of the ocean. So over time, it creates very stable, either clockwise currents that rotate and scour the coastlines of the associated continents, or in the southern hemisphere, counterclockwise rotations that do the same thing. So basically what you have is a kind of a toilet bowl effect, I call it, where you're scouring the edges of the toilet bowl, which is the continents that release most of this debris, and bringing it into the center, which acts as a kind of a accumulator for the trash. A lot of people ask me, well, is the gyre getting bigger? No, the gyres are determined by these geostrophic forces, so it's not the gyres that are increasing in size. What's happening is that the debris that is being accumulated by these gyres is increasing, and so we're starting to see it on the periphery more and not just in the center of these garbage patches.
There are how many garbage patches now?
Five major ones, North and South Atlantic, North and South Pacific, and the Indian Ocean are the major oceanic gyres, and they cover approximately 40% of the world ocean, which if you work that out, it's close to a quarter of the Earth's surface is actually these gyres. Now, they're all remote from land, so they're not a place where, say, for instance, a recreational boater or even a commercial boater would hang out. The same forces that create a terrestrial desert are creating these oceanic deserts, and because they're in the deep ocean away from land, and they're not in, you know, Arctic areas where there's a lot of runoff and they're getting a lot of nutrients, they're nutrient poor. They're what we call depauperate. So in the same sense that a terrestrial desert is devoid of life, except for some hardy species, that's also true of these garbage patches. The only thing I would say that differentiates them from a terrestrial desert is that there's a lot of ocean juvenile species that go to these gyres because they're devoid of large predators to grow up. So small sea turtles and small mola mola, a kind of a fish without a tail that grows to an enormous size. These juveniles hang out in these gyres, these garbage patches. So the fact is that they don't have a lot of life, but the life that they do have is at a very important life stage when it's growing up there. And the fact that we're filling it up with all this plastic waste is having a devastating effect on those juvenile species.
So these gyres are really just islands of plastic garbage.
I would call them more a soup of plastic garbage, not an island. When I first discovered it in 1997, it was just a piece here and a piece there. We didn't really take research equipment out there till 1999 and trawl and get quantitative estimates of the amount of plastic in these garbage patches. So it's been 15 years since we really started measuring and monitoring. And what we do out there is unique in the world of garbage gyres, because most people don't have the wherewithal to go except for one trip on a very sporadic basis. But we've actually been back to the same 11 stations and monitored them over this 15-year period. So we have a running data set of how it's been changing, and I can tell you it's been changing dramatically for the worse. It's growing in quantity of the debris. Now, when I first went out there, people said to me, well, what is it like? Are you like an icebreaker going through, you know, plastic waste that you're just bumping out of your way? And I said, oh, no, no, it's nothing like that. It's just a piece here, and maybe 5 minutes later I'd see another piece. Well, you know, 10 years after that, it was about 10 pieces per minute that we would spot. So it had increased. Now, and 15 years later, in 2014, there's so much stuff there that it is like being an icebreaker. You're going through so much junk, and you can't even count how much is going by the boat. It's that much worse.
Where is it predominantly coming from? Or is this coming from everybody all over the world throwing plastic into the trash?
We always want to combat pollution by looking to find the worst and combat that first. It's just the way that resources are allocated. You allocate resources to combating the worst first. But in the case of plastic pollution, it's such a what we call a non-point source pollutant that you can't locate the worst offender. You try as you will, you can't find who's the worst, because there is no single individual source. It's not a point source, it's a non-point source. And now that even the remotest tribes and the most primitive civilizations wear polyester T-shirts that they've been given by somebody who's visited there, these polyester T-shirts are shedding thousands of fragments every time they're washed. Everybody on the planet now is a contributor. These polyester fragments have gotten so much into the seafood that the average European shellfish eater was just shown in a study to consume 11,000 synthetic fibers in their shellfish consumption each year. So these fibers are everywhere in the environment. These garbage patches accumulate the floating stuff, but the stuff that sinks to the bottom is in somewhere else. We've fundamentally change the nature of the ocean itself into the synthetic polymer soup. And I don't think we have anywhere near the information that we need to say what the consequences of that are. But we do know for a fact that the consequences are deleterious, that millions of animals are dying, starving, being strangled, and caught by this trash. And so it's a dire scenario that is very little understood.
You said in your op-ed piece in the New York Times that plastics are the most common pollutants, but they're also as dangerous as climate change to life on Earth.
Well, what I said in my editorial was that it's a hypothesis that should be seriously tested. What happens with climate change is you get migration toward the poles, right? Things heat up at the equator and things can move. So you do lose species that can't maneuver out of the heat that's being generated and find a more temperate living space that corresponds to what they're used to. But humans can do that. Maybe a smart investment is buying real estate in northern Canada or Siberia or Patagonia or, you know, Tasmania, because we can move out of the way of some of these phenomena that are affecting the planet. But when you're caught in a net of plastic, you can't get away. It's a ghost fishing, they call it, and it's extremely destructive. And the traps that fishermen put out get lost about 10% of them each year, and they are responsible for decimating about 10% of the target catch. So in addition to this kind of getting caught and tangled up in the stuff, there's this other phenomenon where these plastics accumulate pollutants, and they break into these bite-sized bits, and everything we found out there had bite marks on it. It's being chewed up. The ocean is a very sparse place. Animals have to swim a long way to find something to eat. So when they find anything that looks edible, they're going to sample it. And everything is getting sampled. All this trash has been completely chewed around the edges. And these bits that the animals are eating are poison pills. They're up to a million times the level of the pollutants in the surrounding seawater have been sponged up by these bits and are then transmitted through the food web. So you're getting a non-nutritive, non-digestible food mimic put into all these different species. Hundreds of species now have been identified as consuming this stuff. And so it's weakening the fitness of the marine life itself. This needs to be compared to what's happening with climate change and studied.
Let's turn to solutions. You've not been an advocate of recycling because there are some problems there. What are the problems with recycling?
Plastic is not like metal. The age of steel was characterized by a lot of recycling, all right? When replaced steel with plastic in 1979, the production of plastic in the United States outstripped production of steel. When that happened, you got a material that, in the first time in really modern human civilization, the product that defines the age of plastic, that product is not really recyclable in any major way. It has too many problems associated with it. Let me enumerate the problems. First of all, there's too many different types of plastics. You can't mix polycarbonate plastic with polyvinyl chloride plastic and get a usable plastic. You can't mix polyethylene plastic with polyvinyl chloride plastic or with PET plastic, polyethylene terephthalate, and get a usable material. You've got to separate them, but this is not what's done in manufacturing. In manufacturing, they're mixed together because they're used. One might be used for the cap. That's the polypropylene is the cap on most bottles. Then the bottle itself can be polyethylene or polyethylene terephthalate, so it's a totally different plastic. They have to be separated. Then the labeling may be a thin sheet of plastic of another type. Then with your potato chip bags, you've got a sheet of aluminum that's been electroplated onto the plastic to keep moisture in from penetrating so the potato chips stay crisp. That's a whole other layer of problems. Or your Tetra Pak, where you're getting your milk and your soups and your juices in these cardboard packs. There's many layers there that are a nightmare to recycle. Only very few plants are equipped to even tear those things apart and try to get at recycling them. Then when you finally get the stuff separated, you've got to try to clean it, because if you don't clean it, it's not going to be purified in the remelting process. It starts melting at the boiling point of water, about 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees Celsius. That's when your plastics start to melt. This is not going to vaporize greases, oils, contaminants, paints, all the things that you get rid of when you recycle steel or you recycle glass or you recycle aluminum. All those contaminants that get vaporized off and you get that clean metal substrate, that doesn't happen with plastic. So it's illegal to have food contact with recycled plastic because it doesn't get rid of bacteria. Even some nurserymen won't take pots for potted plants out of recycled plastic because they still contain viruses and bacteria that can harm the plant. So it's not purified in the remelting recycling process. So cleaning is very hard. Cleaning this stuff is very difficult because the plastic molecule is an open molecule that is very easy to suck up oily substances. That's why it's used in cleaning up oil spills. All those booms you see around oil spills are made out of plastic because plastic separates oil from water. It will suck up the oil and leave the water. Well, in sucking up the oil, it sucks up all the associated contaminants. So trying to clean that, you really have a hard time. If you've ever tried to maybe reuse a cup that you had some top ramen noodles that you did in the microwave and that little ring of chicken fat, that yellow ring, tried to wash that off with soap and water, it's a very difficult process. The stuff really sticks into the plastic matrix. So you don't purify it when you recycle it, and you have one heck of a time sorting it when you recycle it. Then you have the problem of transporting it to a recycling facility. It's like transporting air. The stuff is so light, especially when you look at the expanded polystyrene, the styrofoam kind of things. You can't make money filling a truck up with something that light. There's no weight to it. You can't get paid for your load. You've got to densify the stuff to make it denser, and that requires some centralized equipment. So it's very impossible, since it's such a universally used substance, and since it goes to every corner of the world, to get that stuff back in quantity that would give you value for your effort is impossible. So we've been created this monster, and we really don't know what to do with it.
California's legislature passed a plastic bag ban. Will this type of activity help?
Every little bit helps. We've got to build awareness that there's a problem in the first place. Most people attack things like the bottle bills and the bag bills as an attack on their convenience, as an attack on their freedom to do as they please and to have these convenient items. That's because they don't realize the serious consequences of having all this stuff blowing around in the environment. We've got to build awareness of these seriousness of the consequences of waste plastic getting into the environment by highlighting these dirty dozen, if you want to call it that, the most polluting plastic, which are the bags, the bottles, and a lot of the insulated food service things, the clamshells and the styrofoam cups and that sort of thing. You know, we have to go after the worst things first, the things that are showing up the most in our cleanups and so on. And those are the three things that are showing up. Fast food is notorious for having the stuff. We don't have trash compactors in our cars. We should, because people live in their cars. They consume food in their cars, and there's no place to put the trash. So typically the door gets open and it gets shoved. People are confronted with waste everywhere. Plastic is a space hog. It takes up more room in the landfill than anything else. And every time there's an event, the trash cans overflow because it's such a space hog. You can't really provide enough receptacles to safely contain it. It's going to be blowing around on the ground after any large public event. So there's a myriad problems with dealing with it, and banning those things that are the first ones that we see when we do our cleanups makes sense.
What are the other potential solutions?
We have to look at a revolution in design. The product must be designed with end of life in mind. We have to have a circular economy. There must be a pre-cycling premium paid by the producers of this material so that they have an incentive to design it so that it's easy to pick up. We can't just externalize forever the costs of cleaning up pollutants that we make as part of our industrial system. Our industrial system has produced miraculous change in the way humans live, but it's at the expense of the natural world. And if we want to have really that non-synthetic habitat exist for ourselves, we don't have a lot of time because we're turning the entire planet into a synthetic habitat. There are places in the world where people really never get out of a synthetic habitat and never really get to experience anything that could be considered natural. They don't care because they don't ever see the natural world as having value. The value is all part of their synthetic lifestyle. I'm very pessimistic because we're creating generations of city dwellers who don't experience any value in the things that we're screwing up with our trash. So they're not incentivized to do anything about it.
Charles Moore, I'd like to thank you for doing this research and sharing it with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Well, thank you for having me today.